Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anazal Ministries podcast. What is the harrowing to hell, and how was King Mickey's journey into the realm of darkness similar to Jesus' journey to hell itself? Guys, I cannot wait to talk about this. We're back with another Kingdom Hearts episode. We're going to be talking about what Jesus did when he went to hell. When King Herod said, go to hell, to Jesus himself, and Jesus said, I bet. And then we're going to talk about King Mickey in the Kingdom Hearts games and his mini trips into the realm of darkness. Guys, you guys know I couldn't possibly be more excited about this. I am Joshua Noah, one of your hosts. And I started laughing a little bit before recording this because it took me a minute to notice Christian Ashley, also here with us, his subtitle today. He wrote his name, Christian Ashley, and then subtitle, like a mouse out of shield. I don't think it's possible to have a funnier subtitle. And I'm jealous. I'm jealous of his creativity. Speaking of creative minds, we're also here with Barbara Early. She, you know, a lot of creative writing stuff. She is the, I was trying to think of the Writers Guild. For some reason, my brain's like the Starving Writers Guild. Is that what it is, right? Is that the full name?
Yeah, there you go, sport.
I'm having a hard brain day. But here to help me with that, I have a minister who's going to pastor me along in my brain farts, the one and only Pastor James Dimmel. How's it going, James?
I'm well in the midst of busy Holy Week and ready to get into a Holy Week topic.
Yeah. So we're recording this before Easter. This is coming out 2 days after Easter, and we're going to be talking about Jesus in hell. And some of you are like, what the hell are you talking about? I can't wait to explain it to you guys. I'm going to have plenty of puns, and I'm sorry about it. But actually, as someone who didn't grow up high liturgical, I hadn't heard much about this topic until more recently. So I'm excited to hear about it from someone who's a little more knowledgeable than myself. We'll have James kind of explain what we're talking about here in a minute. Before we do, want to do a shout out to one of our patrons. Really thankful for James Barrett. Another James, we're thankful for you and your support of the show. We couldn't do this without you, man. You rock. Guys, if you're listening, please rate and review our show over on Podchaser. That gives us the most help. You can also go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, but it helps us a lot if you do it on Podchaser. It helps the algorithm say, hey, these guys are important. Make sure people check this out. And we would greatly appreciate that. And without further ado, we're going to talk about what we're geeking out on really quickly. I was going to say the Ark and do a little quick rant on that, but I'm just going to be honest for the sake of the episode and for the sake of continuity. I currently have Kingdom Hearts Birth by Sleep on pause in the other room. And that's what I'm doing this moment, even. So, Christian Ashley, what are you geeking out on?
Well, seeing that this is most holiest of weeks, I did start the original Devil Man not too long ago. So there's that.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Perfect. James, what are you geeking out on?
Oh, man, I'm still playing through a Tales game, Tales of Arise. It was what I was geeking out on the last time I did a podcast, like 2 weeks ago. And it's literally that long. I think I just got to the last phase of the game this morning.
Nice. All right, Barb, take us home. What are you geeking out on?
Well, we're always geeking out on Pokemon because we sell Pokemon cards now. But we actually just got in stock the brand newest Japanese set. And I am really excited to actually start ripping some of those cards open.
All right, all right. Nice, nice.
I think we need a systematic ecology, like pack opening, live Ooh. Pack opening Ooh.
Episode. It could be on our YouTube shorts or our Instagram reels that everybody should go check out.
Yeah. It's so much fun.
We have a quarterly meeting coming up. We can mention that. See, throw around some ideas. But for now, back to the episode. I am really excited because you guys know I love these games with all of my heart, soul, mm-hmm. mind, and strength. No, I do love these games a lot. I don't love them quite as fervently as I do the Bible. Anyway, I often listen to my audio Bible while playing these games. So I think that counts for, I get points, something. I don't know. James, we're talking about King Mickey, the Realm of Darkness, Jesus is harrowing to hell. And a lot of people are like, wait a minute, how do we know Jesus went to hell? Why did King Herod tell him to go to hell? What is going on here? Why did God send his son not to only die for our sins, but to literally go to the bad place? You know, like what's going on here, James? What is the harrowing of hell?
So I don't know if it's so much that God sent Jesus to the bad place punitively. so early Christian teaching sort of held that Christ descended to the dead or to Hades, hell, the underworld, the lowest parts, as it is literally translated in the Greek. And this thought has been around for a while, sort of under the logic of Christ can't redeem that which he has not known or experienced, right? So the logic of the cross and of justification, salvation, of the incarnation is Christ has to experience it all. Therefore, since he ascended to the Father, he also had to descend to the dead. So you see that line, he descended to the dead, in the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the earliest sort of statements of Christian theology and what Christians believe. This idea of the harrowing of hell, harrowing is a good old English word. So it takes on sort of a life of its own in the Middle Ages in England, and you get all sorts of fun art where on Holy Saturday, Jesus went to hell after his death on the cross, literally to free everyone who was held captive there before his coming. So to put Satan in Satan's place, to set the captives free in hell, and then he is resurrected and then subsequently ascends just before Pentecost to bring the whole thing back up to God, also to sit at the right hand of the Father, and while he's doing so to anger all of the sacramentarians and free church thinkers to come. Christian Ashley smiling at me.
Ah, man. Yeah, so there is a lot there. Some of it, too, it's not just old Christian creeds and stuff, too. Like, my understanding, some of it is also biblically based. When we're talking about, like, in Revelation, it mentions Jesus having the keys to hell and the grave. I cannot help myself. And even Jesus kind of even makes a statement of, I have gone through everything you have gone through, and that's why you can do this temptation. So it's derivative thinking from the Bible that makes it into these earlier creeds.
One of the strongest texts that supports this idea that Christ did descend to hell comes from Ephesians. Ephesians 4, verses 7 to 9. When he ascended on high, he being Jesus, he made captivity itself a captive. He gave gifts to his people. When it says he ascended, what does it mean but that he also descended into lower parts of the earth? He who descended is the same one as he who ascended far above all the heavens so that he might fill all things. So there is some scriptural basis for this. Christ ascended, descended, fills all things, redeems all things. This is a doctrine that is held by definitely some of the more mystical traditions and wings of Christianity. Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, Anglicanism, Lutheranism is also in on this. Martin Luther. Martin Luther's comment on this was basically, don't think about it too much. It's helpful to think that like you're not going to wrap your mind around it. So like, don't get lost. And I think part of So Catholics and Orthodox will still talk about this doctrine a lot. Mm-hmm. Many of them will have Holy Saturday services where they'll recognize this. I think today it's sort of lost on the more mainline evangelical traditions, just because we have such an uncomfortability talking about hell in general, right? Yeah. We'd rather just not look at that or think about that at all. So that I think that's where the mainline Protestant hesitancy comes. There have been other critiques of this doctrine from almost the beginning, and so it's hotly contested. It's hotly contested.
Yeah. So with a little bit of background out of the way there, and we're gonna keep going to theology. It's gonna be a theology heavy episode for us. You know, sometimes we do just like pure fandom, and we hardly ever mention our Christian stuff other than we are Christians. This isn't gonna be one of those episodes. It's gonna be theology heavy, I think. But I do want to take time for everyone, since Christian, me, and Barbara have already mentioned our history with the games. I wanted us to mention our history with this doctrine. When was the first time you heard about it? Then let James talk about his history with the Kingdom Hearts games and just kind of gush over how great this series is. Christian, first, what's your history with just this doctrine? When was the first time you heard the idea that maybe Jesus actually went to hell?
Now, this question baffled me, because I was like, when did I first hear this? Would it have been maybe we recited an Athanasian or Nicene or Apostles' Creed at one point in time in church, and I saw it there or heard it there, and I kind of went, well, that's kind of weird, then moved on with my life? Or was it in college when I was evangelizing to someone and say, hey, do you like literally believe that Jesus went to hell? And I'm like, knee-jerk reaction was yes, and didn't actually put any thought into it later after. So it's honestly one of those theological things that I'm still like stamping out right now, trying to figure out exactly what I think, because I kind of go more towards he went to Sheol instead of hell and took the righteous Jews and Gentiles away. But I couldn't, like, I'm not going to take a bullet for that belief.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then explaining the difference of Sheol and hell and Hades, that can be complicated. Yeah.
Yes.
I'll do mine really quick, because I also don't really know. Like, it was never something talked about, but somehow I just knew it at some point. Like, I don't know when it just entered my brain, if that makes sense. I remember a debate in college with a really close friend of mine. And, you know, I, at that point, had a lot of different beliefs. I was very, I have to evangelize everyone. I kind of more closely subscribed to the ransom theory of atonement kind of stuff. I was not universalist at all back when I met Christian. That's why he liked me back then. And I remember I was talking to a friend, and I was basically trying to, like, you know, evangelize kind of stuff, tell him about Jesus, why he needs Jesus. I was like, oh, Jesus paid the debt for our sins. And he was like, well, if he paid the debt, we all had to go to hell for eternity. So why is Jesus not still in hell? Why wouldn't he just stay there for eternity if that was our punishment and he was taking it? And I'm like, I don't know. I was stumped. I had never even thought about Jesus being in hell outside of he paid the debt for us, and that was our debt. So I kind of, that checks out. Never thought about why he didn't stay there, because that was the real punishment, was eternity there, not go there real quick and leave, you know? Also, if y'all can't tell, I'm not a fan of a ransom theory of atonement anymore. But that's a whole other conversation. Go over to Whole Church Podcast for more of that. Barbara, when was the first time you encountered this idea that maybe Jesus went to hell?
I mean, I feel like I've heard it before, like, somewhere in our history with Crossway, or, you know, just talking to John sometimes late at night, maybe about things we've read in the Bible. But it's, you know, it's only really very recently, especially when you mentioned the idea of doing this podcast, like really getting into the idea that, you know, Jesus died. Where did he go when he died? It's not like he went to heaven. So he must have obviously gone somewhere else. But then it also speaks to, you know, like he went, like, going back and reading the actual scripture, and he went to hell. He spoke to people there, obviously. So,
ooh, that's true too. That's true too. That's also referenced. Okay, James, did you grow up Lutheran? Has it just always been part of your belief? Like, when did you first encounter this? And then when did you first encounter
Kingdom Hearts? I didn't grow up Kingdom Lutheran. I grew up in a Holiness Movement church called the Church of the Nazarene.
Oh, okay.
So almost on the way to Pentecostal, on the way, not there, but on the way. And so, no, I hadn't thought about this at all until I went on my sort of like journey of Christian self-discovery and realization in college and in seminary. And it wasn't really until I got to seminary and was studying Christian theology and experiencing some different services that I encountered this idea for the first time. And I wasn't resistant to it at first, but I just never had really even considered it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about Kingdom Hearts? Now onto the fun stuff. Hard turn. When did Hard you turn. First pick up the world's greatest video game series?
So I picked up the world's greatest and most convoluted video game series.
Amen.
When I was quite young, actually. So I remember being probably in the fifth grade, 9, 10, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. I just got my PS Christmas. And went to the local, back before it was GameStop, it was EB Games.
Yes!
Their throwback. And I went and I was like, you know, talking to the probably like 19-year-old who was working there at the time. And I want a fun, good adventure game with a good story that I can like just sit in. And he was like, let me tell you about Kingdom Hearts. And so I bought Kingdom Hearts and I took it home. And I spent 10 hours trying to figure out how to get off Destiny Islands, and things got wild from there. So it's been a big part, yeah, for me, one of my favorite game series.
Yeah, I remember when I first had those two evangelists show up at my door, and have we told you the good news of our Lord and Savior, the Kingdom Hearts video game series? No, in all seriousness, I actually, the way that I found it, I know we talked about our history before, but I just think this is an amusing anecdote. I had thought that I misunderstood Lilo and Stitch's commercials for Kingdom Hearts. So I picked up Kingdom Hearts thinking that it's what I saw. Because the old Lilo and Stitch commercials, when it first came out, mind you, this was around the same time, it was Stitch showing up in Aladdin. It was Stitch showing up in all these other places. And then I saw this game where all the places were. I was like, oh, that must have been what the commercial really was. I must have just thought it was Lilo and Stitch. Turns out, no, they really did have those Lilo and Stitch commercials. So, but anyway, I found out it was truly Kingdom Hearts. I fell in love with the game after a year of being stuck on Destiny Island. I had no idea. Like, this was my first RPG. I had no idea what to do. I actually beat the game the first time with the Kingdom Key because I didn't know you could change weapons.
How do you not know that, though?
I had never even heard of RPG. Like, I had no context.
That's
honestly, I appreciate the purist.
I'll never do it again, though.
you can get a trophy doing that now, I think, actually.
I know, and I keep thinking about it. I'm like, I deserve the trophy because I've went through this hell. I was like, you know what? I'm not going through it again. I just can't make myself. Now, I do want to throw out a quick caveat. We're not going to be saying Kingdom Hearts is secretly telling this message of the Bible. I think I can speak pretty confidently that no one here thinks the creators of Kingdom Hearts was intentionally. James's maybe. Yeah. No, I don't think they were intentionally making this comparison or trying to make Mickey out to be Jesus. I do think some truths are just embedded in the human soul. And when we tell stories that sometimes these truths just kind of accidentally slip out of the deepest parts of us. And I think we're going to see some of that. But what we're going to do, we're not going to be doing like, oh, here's theology. We're going to try to make Kingdom Hearts Christian. We're just going to treat them like two different stories. And compare and contrast these two stories of Jesus going to hell and what happened to Mickey. So we told you about Jesus going to hell. So now let's tell you about Mickey Mouse. Some of you may have never heard of Mickey Mouse. The real king. You know, I've been watching Game of Thrones and they're like the true king of the north. And I'm like, nah, dude, the only true king of the realms is Mickey Mouse. James, will you unpack the history of Mickey Mouse in the Kingdom Hearts games? Like, who is Mickey? Where did he come from? What is his character, not like in Disney, but specifically in this game series?
Okay, yeah. King Mickey is a big character in the Kingdom Hearts series that we don't meet until probably we know of him. We don't meet him until the very conclusion of the Kingdom Hearts game. So Disney Castle is one of the many worlds in the Kingdom Hearts series. Mickey is the king. Mickey's history is that he is trained by Master Yensid, who is definitely, his name is not spelled backwards. And and he discovers that something is awry amidst the worlds that darkness is taking them over, and goes on a journey, leaves his home, leaves his beloved retainers, Donald and Goofy, behind to go on this journey to the core of darkness and figure out what is up. So he is absent for most of the first Kingdom Hearts game. And Donald and Goofy are left with the command to go find the wielder of the Keyblade. At this point, we think there's only one Keyblade. Ah, those were the days. So they end up finding Sora in Traverse Town, and they go on a journey together to try and find King Mickey where he's at, and also to do some other things and prevent darkness upon darkness being unleashed. And so, yeah, we finally do see Mickey at the end of the first game. At the conclusion, Sora is fighting Ansem, the Seeker of Darkness, and they are going to seal the door. I believe it's the door to darkness, so that darkness can no longer come through and imperil the worlds. And Sora and Mickey both have to seal it from respective sides of the door to darkness. Mickey being in the realm of darkness, and Sora being in the realm of light. And that's how the first game ends, as we get this awesome silhouette of King Mickey raising the Kingdom Key D in parallel with Sora. There you go.
Yeah. I'm going to backtrack a little bit further, even with that. So the first game comes out, and people think Star Wars has a problem with not releasing an order. But that's because they haven't entered the realm of Kingdom Hearts players, where we're playing some of these games having absolutely no idea where they take place in the timeline. And then they do time travel on top of it for some reason, because I said, you know what, it's not complicated enough. Mm-hmm. But then we have two different realms and a digital realm that they just created because, you know what, there's not enough realms already out there. Let's make a new one.
I'm pretty sure not even Tetsuya Nomura knows.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody knows.
Absolutely not.
He's getting his money though.
What's wild is I keep flipping back and forth as these games come out, where I'm like, either this man is a genius and planned this stuff out from the beginning, or he just so happens to find the perfect explanations for stuff all the time, and it just irritates us all because it's like,
probably that one.
How did you explain this stuff? So for those who don't know, Kingdom Hearts 2.8 came out because they like to infuriate us. They couldn't have Kingdom Hearts 1, 2, and 3. They had to have Kingdom Hearts 1, Chain of Memories, Kingdom Hearts 2, prequel to the prequel, prequel to the second game, prequel to the third game. Well, 2.5, where we have parts of all of it. Then we'll have 2.8, where we have parts of a lot of it. And then we're just going to randomly add this thing, Kingdom Hearts Birth by Sleep, Kingdom Hearts 0.2, the Fragment Passage. And you're like, they just tried to irritate us. They played us knowing that we would do it and knowing that we'd find it funny. So they just made fun of us, and we were all in on the joke, and it was fine. Even up to when Kingdom Hearts 3 came out, in the prelude to it, they called Kingdom Hearts 2.9 because they just thought that was funny.
2.9.
That was so great. I think I literally hit the floor laughing when they did that. It's like they know. Mm-hmm. But Fragmentary Passage really explained a lot of this stuff in Kingdom Hearts 1 that you're like, oh, wait a minute. So that's what Mickey was doing. Oh, it all makes perfect sense. He must have planned this. And then you remember, no, he did not. There's just no way he did.
We interrupt our regularly scheduled podcasting for an important message. My name is Tejas. I come to you today to inform you that for as little as $0.00 a week, you could in fact help us by joining our Discord channel. We'd love to talk to you guys there. There's a ton you can do on Discord. You can hang out with us, talk directly to all of the hosts, ask us questions, get more involved in our community, and join in future watch sessions. We like to hop in a voice channel and stream something and watch it that way. That's a really cool way to, you know, get that sitting on the couch experience from home and, you know, living a couple hundred miles away from each other. It is my favorite thing. I would really appreciate it if some of you joined so we could hang out some more. Thanks. And back to your regularly scheduled podcast programming.
Hey friends, this is your pal, Will Rose, and I have some exciting news. Systematic Geekology will return to Theology Beer Camp this year, October 17th through the 19th in Denver, Colorado. And we hope that you can join us. We are part of Theology Beer Camp in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, at my home church in my hometown. And that year, Theology Beer Camp was called the God Pods. And then we were in Missouri, a part of the Geek Stage. Yes, we had a whole entire Geek Stage where we had workshops and speakers and had incredible conversations. And Theology Beer Camp last year was called the God Pods Strike Back. So you kind of see where this is going. And so this year, the theme is the return of the God Pods. And so if you head over to Eventbrite and follow God Pods 2024, or hop over to Instagram, follow it there. And if you enter promo code Geekshire, you see what we did there? Yeah. Wilbo Baggins approves. If you enter Geekshire, all caps, no spaces, you'll get $25 off your ticket price. Geekshire, all caps, no spaces, Geekshire. Yes, yeah, say it with me, Geekshire. Enter that, you get money off your ticket, and you can join us and hang out and drink beer and have great food. And even if you don't drink beer, you can have incredible food and beverages and conversations with your favorite host here at Systematic Ecology. The Geek Stage is growing. I'm proud of that, and we thank Tripp for this opportunity. We hope to see you at Theology Beer Camp, the Return of the God Pods 2024.
But yeah, so Fragmentary Passage, Birth by Sleep, and even Dream Drop Distance kind of gets to some of Mickey's story before he was king, even. Before he turned king. Christian, what do you remember of his stories before being king that you could elaborate for us?
Yeah, sure. I apologize for your running water in the back. I'm having some maintenance done in the dorm. Nothing I can really control. So really, he kind of starts off, we go to the pass in a timeless river, and we see Mickey's and his younger Steamboat Willie kind of days, and his more like the 20s, 30s cartoon kind of sense, and gets to that point where you kind of travel in between parts of his history, and he never speaks to you because, of course, it's, you know, silent at this point in time in animation. So at best, he'll shake your hand like we see in the photo here, and you never really learn each other's names. He's working for Pete, who at this time is still an okay guy. Houdin falls along the way. Then in what is seemingly the same world, but a different part of it, we get to the country of the Musketeers, where this is where Minnie is actually the queen of. King Mickey is not a king at this point in time. We're not exactly told when that, maybe it's when he gets married to Minnie along the way, and the events of the Three Musketeers Disney movie is how Nomura kind of brings that about. Was that the plan? Definitely not. But he makes it work in his Nomura-ish way. So through the events of that film and, you know, through the events of Dream Drop Distance, Mickey's able to prove himself, then become king. But then after that, goes to Yen Sid to learn how to protect his kingdom, knowing about the growing threat of the darkness, wants to become a Keyblade Master, honestly, in kind of almost a possible stable time loop, in that he has seen Sora in one world while he's dreaming. So that, your mileage may vary about how the heck that works. And another in the actual past in Timeless River. So it's all over the place. It just works.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's I don't think it's possible to understand it all, and that's fine. To make it even more complicated, because we can, we have to talk about the events happening in the game that I'm playing in the other room that's on pause right now. We're talking about Birth by Sleep, because that's where you see Mickey first show up with a Keyblade. So he's training, and he has... and if you don't know, throughout the games, the king receives both the keys to the grave and death. I mean, Kingdom Key D, as well as the Star Seeker. He does have two different keys. He starts with Star Seeker. I believe he gets that from Yen Sid while they're training. He's able to... It's very confusing, because sometimes Keyblades are like wands in Harry Potter, and the wand chooses it, and then sometimes it's just like an item, maybe. And sometimes this is the Keyblade that's the Star Seeker. And then sometimes I just put a keychain on my Keyblade, and now it looks like the Star Keeper. It does. So he's gifted this Keyblade called the Star Seeker from Yen Sid. And he plays through this game encountering, I think the most significant person he encounters is probably Vanitas and Aqua. This is Christian's favorite of the Kingdom Hearts games. I'm going to throw it to him one more time. I'll let other people explain the next part. But what happens with Mickey and the rest of Birth by Sleep?
It's at this point he's trying to become a Keyblade Master. He's been training for Yen Sid for an unspecified amount of time. And as part of his like mastery, exam or whatever they call it, he ends up traveling from world to world haphazardly because he doesn't really know how to do it yet. He doesn't have the cool armor that everyone else does, which how did that blow your mind the first time you saw it? Why hasn't Sora been able to do that yet? And
I need space armor.
He meets Ventus first, I think, in the Keyblade graveyard, helps him with fighting Vanitas, then along the way kind of barely interacts with Terra, and with Aqua helps her defend a young Kairi, who, by the way, is from a different world from the world we see her in the first game, you know, because Nomura's got a Nomura. And it's his process of becoming friends with the three of them. Terra a little less so. Not that he hates him or anything. They just don't interact as much compared to the other two. Fighting against the machinations of Master Xehanort, failing to save any of them. And he kind of even says, like, hey, I'm not even worthy of this. But Yen says, yes, you are. And makes him a master at this point in time, because they kind of need people like him to get stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what's interesting in this, I feel like the three main characters are too close to the situation to see it. And you almost need Mickey, who's kind of an outsider, to really see what's going on. Because mm-hmm. he sees the darkness starting to consume these worlds, and the worlds are going to sleep. And they're too busy looking for each other, looking for, like, the Jedi Master Councils. I don't know. It has very High Republic vibes to me for some reason. But mm-hmm. Xehanort is actually part of the Keyblade Masters at this point. So it's like they don't know how bad he is yet. And Mickey's able to see what's going on and then kind of intervene and say, wait, these three are good guys. They're being deceived. And he knows kind of what's up. And then he sees the sacrifice that Aqua makes. And he ends up going into the first time he goes to the Realm of Darkness was actually for Aqua. Barbara, how much do you remember about this part of the story with Aqua and Mickey?
I vaguely remember this part. It's been a while since I played this particular game, but I remember he chased after her into the darkness.
Yeah.
I don't quite remember how long he stayed in there, but he couldn't rescue her, I believe. And then eventually they have to go and find Aqua in the Dark Realm. But it's been a while since I played this particular one.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he goes in after her, but he's not able to rescue her. But that's where they start kind of fighting. I think this is where he learns that that he lives in the Realm of Light and there is such a thing as the mm-hmm. Realm of Darkness. I think this is kind of where he learns that. James, anything to add about this bit? Because this is where it gets confusing and you have to, like, play multiple games to get one part of a story.
To understand that one part, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've always gotten that timeline a little bit confused. But when the first time he goes to follow Aqua, and then when he goes back to find the Kingdom Key D specifically.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we do know he does go in after somebody into the Realm of Darkness for one mm-hmm. person that he really only kind of knows, because he saw her sacrifice and thought that she was worthwhile to go after in an mm-hmm. unknown realm. Okay, that's all I got for going back for Aqua. so we're gonna move on. Kingdom Key D. We've talked about it a few different times. Barbara, do you want to take this one too? Of like, how does Mickey end up with a new Keyblade? He no longer has the Star Seeker when he finds this one.
I don't quite remember exactly how he acquired the Kingdom Key D, but I do know that he can use it to seal. And I can't quite remember if he can unseal as well the Realms of Darkness. So that's how he was able to seal the door from the inside in the very end of the first game.
Yeah.
From this letter.
To me, this was the most miraculous of explaining, where you were like, some of this will never, ever make sense. And it was obvious that they just didn't know there was other Keyblades. And then they unpack this bit of stuff and you're like, wait a minute, what? Mickey's just a genius and this all makes perfect sense. So in the beginning, he just tells Donald and Goofy what James was mentioning earlier. He just tells them, look for the key, which makes it sound like there's only one Keyblade. But he mm-hmm. goes into the Realm of Darkness in Traverse Town. So it's not that Kingdom Key D has any specific powers that others don't have. He intentionally went to the opposite place, knowing they would find the light version of the same key that he's going to find the dark version of. Because you need both the light and dark of the same weapon to lock mm-hmm. Kingdom Hearts or the Realm of Darkness. So
that's
like, you think you're on this wild goose chase and they just happen to find the one key that works and all this stuff. And we went like 15 years all thinking that this just was all some weird coincidence. But nope, Mickey's just a mastermind and he figured this out. And he shows up at that scene we had at the beginning that James was talking about at the end of Kingdom Hearts 1 where he's there. Mm-hmm. That's how that all played out. And you're like, oh, OK, The one thing that's interesting, that's weird, I didn't realize till I was doing research for this. Why doesn't he wield both keys? Like, that was my thing. It's like, why not just have two keyblades? It takes a heart to roll a key. So the reason that only Sora then Roxas can wields two keyblades is they're the only ones with multiple hearts. I never put that together. That's wild.
Yeah. It's interesting. I used to think like each keyblade was endemic to like the world it was found in. Like each keychain like went with the door in that specific world. But then like when you started to get into like the mobile game and like Keyblade War, and then just like everyone was having keyblades, that logic sort of went by the way for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was it got weird. It stays weird. It's fine. I think what one of the interesting bits here too, though. So this is also where when we do our contrast, the big contrast is that Mickey is not God. He does not know that they're going to beat the darkness. He doesn't know everything that's going to happen. He's still learning as they go, which if you subscribe to like process theology, Tom Ord kind of stuff, maybe you could still make that fit. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not a process theologian, so I'm not sure how they would define the realm, like the limits of that. But Mickey is still learning as he goes. So when he first gets Kingdom Key D, he's able to see that this weapon he got in the realm of darkness is able to defeat the darkness. And he thinks he needs to completely seal off the darkness and destroy darkness until later on he runs into Riku, and Riku kind of shows him actually, no, the light and dark need each other, and light and dark isn't the same as good and evil. So I always thought that was a really fascinating part of the story. James, how do you wrestle with that kind of part of this where he meets someone who's able to use the darkness for good and realizes darkness itself isn't necessarily evil? Like how do you make sense of all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the core themes of the games, plural. You don't really get that much in Kingdom Hearts 1, but when you start getting into Chain of Memories and 358 over 2 days, and especially Kingdom Hearts 2, right, where Riku becomes a Keyblade wielder and is able to use both light and dark powers, you sort of experience, like, all over the place these worlds with, like, people who try to do good or would say that they ascribe to the light, who end up doing all of these awful things in service of it as just as easily as folks who serve darkness would. And so it becomes much more ambiguous, and you end up with something like more of like a balance that's needed for both, a balancing of the scales. And so I think one of the themes is light can become corrupt just as easily as darkness can. They're not equivalent to good and evil. You somehow need both in balance.
Yeah. What's interesting in these games too is they don't take like a hard balance is the answer kind of thing either, because you do have like Organization 13. A lot of them want to use dark and light. You know, they need both the Princesses of Heart and 13, you know, Keys of Darkness or whatever. And then if you get into the mobile games, there's all kinds of players that are using both light and dark for evil reasons. So it's not like balance is the ultimate good. Yeah. It's just kind of like the light and dark part of the question doesn't factor into, are you good or not? Like, just because you're a part of the church, just because you're part of this or that, just because you're darkness or because you're light does not mean you are either good or evil. And I think that's an important part of the game's message, that I'm glad they don't turn it into, you have to have both and then you're good. And that, like, they let it be a little more nuanced. Then we need both, and that evil is different. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts on this particular part? All right. For those wondering, Christian is in agreement that we do need dark and light. He's become universalist now and thinks evolution is true. So moving forward.
I knew it. This was the podcast.
We're changing all of Christian's views while he's off air. Sorry. For those listening, Christian's not currently here to defend himself. And I apologize, Christian, for later. So let's go into like some of the deeper themes here. I want to start with some of the more obvious ones of the game for me, and then get into the comparison stuff. Aqua is willing to sacrifice herself for Terra. And then you see Mickey going after someone he barely knows. He goes to the realm of darkness for Aqua. He goes in after Riku. Like, he goes time and time again just to save people into literally something that's called the realm of darkness. Mind you, he's the king of light. He is the king of the realm of light, going into the realm of darkness itself or these individual people on a couple of different instances. So which makes me ask the question, you know, even before I get to the theology of just kind of like, what am I willing to do? Like, am I willing to go into like the realm of darkness? Like, you know, for somebody else, like even my close friends, I'm not sure how much I'd be willing to do that for. James, you ever wrestle with questions like this?
Yeah. Like how far would you go off the straight and narrow if it was necessary to, you know, defend or save someone you love? No, yeah. I mean, I think about this all the time. Like, just, I mean, for me, the broader question is, are you willing to get your hands dirty for good ends? Can there ever be reasons that justify morally reprehensible, seemingly, actions to get you there? Would you sacrifice yourself for someone? I think about this all the time in my ministry and like how much I give of myself and like where the boundary is. Because I could spend all day in the hospital, or I could, like, you know, there's always going to be someone who needs you out there. So I wonder about the limits of that all the time.
Yeah, I Just to make this conversation a lot more complicated, I've always been of the go wherever it takes to help somebody, right? Like we do all things for all people. Well, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. There is no limit. Yep. And then, you know, I kind of heard some stories and saw some stuff happen where it's somebody went in, which someone I was close to, same kind of philosophies as I did, went to a drug house because they knew people who were there and they were trying to help these people. And they were kind of being present to try and get them out of the situation. But it kind of backfired because a lot of the people that were part of the youth at their church, all they heard was that so-and-so was at the drug house.
Right.
So then it actually brought up more questions and more problems. So it's like, did going into the darkness actually help in that situation? I don't think it did, you know?
Right.
So I think it gets really complicated when we're talking about like, how far are we willing to go? It's never just I'm helping one person or hurting one person. There's ramifications outside of that. And what do people see? And, you know, throw in that Bible verse of, how you're supposed to, avoid even the bad reputation, anything that could even let people say ill of you, avoid it. So just, I don't know. It's a big question. Christian Ashley, we already told everybody that you're a universalist now and believe evolution. Could you tell? Oh. Yeah, we wow, changed all your views while you were gone.
I'd argue character regression, but sure.
Well, character regression. Oh, I love it. Go ahead.
Sorry for everyone. I was dealing with some maintenance on my end on the dorms, so I had to leave for a little bit. So I've missed a conversation. I'm just letting the listeners know. So, yeah, questions. Let me hear them.
Yeah. So right now we're talking about like how Mickey has gone several times into the realm of darkness for some individual people just to help. Some of them he didn't even really know that well. And we're asking ourselves, how far are we willing to go to help others? Are you like able to go off of the straight and narrow path, or are you like, what would you do to help someone else?
Like most things, it depends on context. Like, you know, for Daniel, God didn't say, hey, throw yourself into the lion's den. You know, Daniel was doing his job. He was worshiping God, and that's what got him thrown into the lion's den. And then he had angels come and save him. You know, when it comes to other people, we have to be willing to look out for them as best we can. But it depends on a scenario. Like, if I know a friend of mine is somewhere where I cannot reach them, I'm not going to go all Punisher, guns a-blazing, just to get them out, because that would end poorly, because I don't own a gun. So I would probably have to steal one to get that done. That's not a good, effective way of doing things. I'd have to, you know, call the proper authorities or contact people around them that I know would be able to help back me up if I were to go to that scenario and get them out of it. You know, sometimes you got to go alone. Sometimes it means you have to go to that house of that person you know maybe is a little rougher than you would imagine yourself being around, and just having a conversation with them. Or it could mean you bring another person if you're afraid. Like, don't go into a situation knowing things will end poorly if you haven't prepared for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why Mickey fails multiple times over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, but because and that's why they don't tell Sora as well, because Sora is going to do exactly what Mickey does, but worse, because it's one of those things is he wants to help people. Mickey wanted to help Aqua get out. Sora, who's never once met her in his life, wants to do the same, because that's just who he is. And that's why they keep that information away, because he's going to make a stupid, reckless decision that Mickey, who is wiser, made a stupid, reckless decision multiple times over. And even when he brings Riku with him, it's still not enough. Even though both of them are Keyblade Masters, they're just not ready. So sometimes it takes dipping your toes in that situation, going, okay, oh, we got our butts kicked. Let's get back and find out who we need to bring with us to make this better the next time around.
Yeah. Yeah. There's two sides of this conversation, and you really can't have one without the other, right? Like if you're going to ask me personally, if I could knowingly that either me or my brother's going to go to hell, choose which one's going, I'm going, you know, like I'll just eternal torment. Here we go. But it's never that cut and dry of an equation, I feel like. And this is also, this goes into what our listeners are tired of hearing me complain about utilitarianism. Because, like, that's the whole problem, right? There's this level of arrogance. You know, we'll go to that Cap versus Iron Man, where Iron Man's like, yeah, of course it's evil if the government's ruling the Avengers. But if we play in, we can kind of have a say. And, you know, he makes this utilitarian argument. And Cap's thing is, actually, you have no idea what the outcome will be. So we just have to make the right decision, because the right decisions will lead to the best outcomes in the end. And it takes a huge amount of arrogance to say, no, actually, I know better. I know better than all of this. I know exactly what the outcomes will be because I know all of the different things that could possibly influence what will happen here. And it's like, that's just arrogant, right? Like in some instances, and this is where I get into like even politics, some instances we might see where, hey, making this government mandate, whatever, everyone's going to have to get a vaccine. In this instance, makes a lot of sense. Making it the law of the land, all of a sudden, you don't know what other things will creep up later. And if you just have a simple law that was only tailored to one situation, the negative effects that will happen in other situations. So that's where like you have to understand nuance before you do anything like this. And it's never just, hey, I'm going to trade myself for one other person. Like it's never like that.
It's interesting here to even consider like the when and how of Jesus going to the cross. Right. Because throughout the Gospels, right, like you get in Mark in secret, Jesus telling everyone he heals and does acts like, don't tell anyone yet. And then Palm Sunday comes and suddenly I'm here. This is the time. Or you get the language in the Gospel of John, you know, where he avoids capture all those times because he has some nuance because the text says over and over his time had not yet come. And then on Maundy Thursday, he realizes the hour has now come and it's time. Well, why didn't Jesus just come and rush straight to the cross and, you know, get it over with and be out? You know what I mean? If that was what it was all about. And so I do think there are some, like, there are moments where undeniably, and this is probably like, you know, some Holy Spirit working on your heart, like this is the time, this is the moment to take a stand. This is something I know only I can do and I'm prepared to do and all of that stuff. There are other times where I think you have to be really discerning about, can I do this? Am I doing this for the right reasons or am I doing this for me? And a whole gamut of complexities there.
It all gets complicated. And a lot of this does go to, and yeah, this is our post-Easter episode, everybody. So I was trying not to get too deep into this, but a lot of it does go to our atonement theories. Like, what are we thinking about? On the Whole Church podcast, we had Trip Fuller on, and he made a statement that really like illuminated how some of these happen and make a lot of sense for me of like, usually your different Christian theologies, they pick an instance. This is when salvation happened, and they explain the other events around that. So it'll be salvation happened when Christ was embodied in humankind, and the embodiment of the divine spreads to all of us, and we are saved in that instance. And if you're taking that model, then the cross is like exemplary of the evil of man, and then the resurrection is exemplary of the goodness of God. But then you have models that are the cross. That is the salvation event. Jesus only came so that he could die, and the resurrection was proof that God was behind it all. Or you'll have the resurrection is salvation. And, you know, like we pick one and we explain the others around it. And it's probably a lot more mysterious than that and a lot more, a little bit of something that maybe we just humans can't fully grasp. And we just keep trying to put words to something that we don't quite have the words for, which is also how we come up with stuff like the heroine of hell. Because, you know, it makes sense on some context, and then sometimes you think about it and you're like, wait, what is this Kingdom Hearts stuff? Like, what? So how do you guys think? Let's just get to the question that the episode's titled after, that everybody listened to and was like, wait, are they gonna answer the question? How does this compare and contrast? What do you think are the biggest similarities, biggest differences of Mickey going to the realm of darkness and Jesus going to hell, if we're taking both of the stories just as stories and not saying this is absolutely what happened? Barbara, let's start with you.
Well, I feel like if you're comparing the two stories, if you're just taking it as a story, there's one key difference, though. Like, when Mickey is going into the realm of darkness, he doesn't know if he's going to come back. He's just following Aqua into the realm to try to bring her back, you know, try to save her from the darkness. But when you compare it to the story of Jesus and his harrowing to hell, he knows he's coming back. I mean, he's going to minister to the people who are going to experience salvation in hell, like due to his word and to the teachings of his father. And then he is coming back to earth. You know, he knows that already. But in Mickey's experience, he doesn't know that. So that's like the biggest difference, I think, for me.
Yeah, it's this is going to be really weird. But, you know, in theology, we say Jesus is fully human and fully God. And we just have a really hard time understanding that. In a way, just looking at the stories, it's easier to understand Mickey as human than it is Jesus, right? Like, it's easy to see Mickey having this very human experience of not knowing if he's coming back and all this stuff. Whereas, like, to us, Jesus is God. Of course he knew he was coming back. But then for me, I wrestle with, just being honest, this, how much of a sacrifice is it really if you know you're going to come back? You know, like, I'm like, I might be able to die if I know I'm coming back. Like, you know?
But there's that key word, might.
Yeah, that it's
would
a big might, but it's also like
utterly make
somehow
that decision.
It feels like a bigger sacrifice if you don't know, you know, like just
but
thinking
also,
about it as a story.
You have to think of, like, if you already know what you're going to experience and you know there's pain coming, though, are you still going to do it knowing that there's going to be pain involved and suffering? Like a lot of people probably wouldn't.
Yeah. All right, James, shed some light on this crazy conversation. Compare and contrast yourself. A comment on what we've said so far.
Yeah,
you know, pastor us through.
Pastor us through it. It's interesting, you know, the logic of Jesus going to save the people who were there, right? To redeem those who were in hell before he came. That logic is very similar to the times Mickey tries to go to the realm of darkness to rescue Aqua.
Yeah.
And even when Mickey and Riku go in Kingdom Hearts 3, or even when Sora finally joins them after begging the whole half of the game to go.
Please, Daddy, let me go to hell.
There's
hold on,
there's
son.
There's similarity there. The other half is Jesus. Part of the harrowing of hell thought is Jesus goes down, to use a very Gen Z term, just to spin the block on Satan and like flex on him and be like, you're done. I got you.
I love this take.
That is part of it, right?
Yeah.
And so similarly, when Mickey goes looking specifically for the Kingdom Key D, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that he can seal with Sora the door to darkness and potentially, like, you know, in this fight for good, right? Some sort of like victory or totality of just like ending the story and saying darkness is sealed. Like, there, I think that is too, right? So part of the harrowing of hell is, you know, the final victory and triumph spiritually over Satan. And so, yeah, I think there's so much left in the Kingdom Hearts story to be explained yet. Are Mickey, is Sora, are they like messianic type figures? I think in particular with Sora, there's a lot left to be explained that the game hints at, that the games hint at all along, but there's never really been a fully focused, fledged out sort of exploration of it yet. I think it is to come. And I think maybe even Kingdom Hearts 4, I think there's going to be some stuff going on with that. I mean,
also the Master of Masters coming back. Calling it now.
No, seriously. That,
that's just a thing.
So I think like the biggest difference is, you know, we don't know the messianic status of Mickey or of Sora in these missions, right?
Yeah.
And so it's more similar to, do I go to a dark place to save a friend?
Well, then this something you brought us what I think is one of the big differences that also highlights one of me and Christian's biggest differences in thought. So this will be fun because he'll go next. Mickey thought by sealing the door to Kingdom Hearts that'll stop darkness from coming altogether. And it did limit some, but people still had that darkness in their hearts, right? Like there was still like, that was not a final victory. Whereas I will argue Jesus, when he went to hell and came back, he came back with keys to hell and the grave, and he fully defeated. All are saved, right? Like, I'm like, that's not a partial victory. Jesus didn't, maybe this will kind of win. I think the big difference that Christian and I have is Christian will say, well, it gave everyone the opportunity, but people still have evil in their heart. So it wasn't a final victory. So Kingdom Hearts is closer to Christian theology maybe than mine. Maybe. Christian, what do you think?
When it comes to Kingdom Hearts in the Bible, there are many ways you can interpret matters, as we've noted in just this one episode.
I love that sentence. Quote, we need to throw that up on Instagram.
Put that one on a t-shirt. Yeah, I think to go with what you said first, as I said, I'm still developing my theological like interpretations of how this is supposed to go. The harrowing to hell. Is it actually him going to hell? Is it him going to Sheol? I think it's him going to Sheol, going to the people, the righteous Jews, the righteous Gentiles that were like Naaman the Aramean or Melchizedek, who were in a kind of a waiting period so they could be brought up to glory with him. Like the thief on the cross, he tells him that day, you'll be with me in paradise. So I kind of go, if Jesus is in hell that whole time, is that true? Or is there something I'm missing there? So I haven't fully developed my theology on that.
My mind's just blown that you don't think Melchizedek is Jesus. That's all. Continue.
He is like Jesus in certain aspects.
That's a different Bible podcast.
Yeah. But I think if we're going to take this as Jesus is actually going to hell to talk to everyone there, I say this as someone who does not believe in everyone coming back and there being no universalism. I think if this is actually Jesus going to hell, this is him going to people who he's given their last possible chance to say yes to him. And maybe as someone who doesn't think people in hell would ever say yes to him, maybe they did in this scenario. Maybe they're able to come back. But as far as this whole thing, it's kind of to compare and contrast it to Mickey is leaving the 99 to go after the one. Jesus is leaving everything to try to get as many as possible with him. And in some circles would say everyone. I highly disagree. But I think that's one of the key differences is that Mickey is going for a chance to get back one and a chance to seal darkness. Jesus is going for the guarantee of those who are his and to destroy the gates of hell forever as far as the people who are going to be his.
Yeah. Now, and Jesus, in the defense of all of this, Jesus didn't have to worry about Jesus too. Like, there isn't a second video game, you know? Like Kingdom Hearts has to worry about what's happening next. You know, we can't just have no more Heartless. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It also doesn't help that we didn't know the Aqua was a thing until 10 some years down the road. And even when they're making Kingdom Hearts 2, Nomura admitted, yeah, I just made like 3 character designs and I had them in armor because I didn't know what they looked like. So there's that.
That's fantastic.
Man, so yeah. I would argue that Nomura is not inerrant like scripture is.
Yeah, honestly, the more I think about it, the more we're talking, the more I feel like in these games, I think he intentionally created something convoluted every now and then. I think he was like, I'm going to come up with something. You know what? Kyrie's born on a different planet. Just so that later he could try to reconcile it. Like, I think the author of the video games, like the writer, is just constantly trying to make it harder for him to reconcile the story just to see if he could do it. Like, I feel like that's what's happening. And we're all just part of his little experiment. Man. Yeah, this is tough. I definitely think that, yeah, for me, the biggest contrast is that, yeah, like you said, the finality of it all. Yeah, even if we disagree on the levels of finality, what Jesus did was final. Those who are saved indeed, right? Like, whereas what Mickey did kind of sealed the door to darkness. Maleficent can still call up Heartless, you know, like it's not like that battle in Kingdom Hearts 2 never happened. I still think what he did was meaningful. And I think it is really insightful of the philosophy the game's trying to teach us that Mickey went after a key of darkness so that he could try to defeat darkness itself. Like, I feel like there's a lot of meaning and philosophy behind it. And I don't want you to undermine what Mickey did or the power of the story of the game. There's power in story, and it's a powerful story. But it's nowhere near as final as what Jesus did. And then, I'm going to echo what James said. I think the biggest similarity is going to just be how Mickey went after the one, just that idea of him going there to see who was there and reaching out. You know, Will's mentioned before, one of his favorite iconographies was this picture of Jesus's harrowing to hell as he's reaching out to Adam and Eve. And to me, I get the same, like, I get that chill when I see, wait a minute, let me put it back up here. You got a Mickey showing up to Aqua in the Realm of Darkness, where he didn't even know what the Realm of Darkness was. Yeah, that image for me, that's a powerful image. Is it sacred? Is it holy? No. Is it powerful? Yeah. Yeah, that's a powerful image. All right. Anybody have any final notes? Any more theology or nerdology you want to drop on us before we wrap this one up?
I'm good.
James looks like he has something.
I'm just going back and forth in that argument that Sora and Sin, the Seeker of Darkness, is Kingdom Hearts darkness or light?
Ooh.
You know, yeah. The door to Kingdom Hearts being in the depths of the Realm of Darkness. Anthem finally opens it. It's light. Or is it? We don't know. TBD. I mean, it's hard to answer this question ultimately. Like, I wonder, like, if this is a topic we can revisit in 50 years when Kingdom Hearts 10 comes out and story finally ends. To look back and say what was really going on. There was just so much about Kingdom Hearts that, like, over 20 years in, we still somehow don't know.
Yeah, and at different points in the timeline of the games coming out, I would have answered this differently, right? Like, when Kingdom Hearts 1 came out, man, yeah, it felt like Mickey must just be Jesus, right? Because we get to the deepest pits of darkness, and it looks like Mickey himself is the light, maybe, in the midst of the darkness that is our salvation. And then you learn a little bit more. You're like, wait a minute, Mickey had no idea what he was doing. Right. And you learn more about, like, the humanity of Mickey Mouse. It's just kind of which also maybe that's the biggest takeaway. Isn't how similar are these two? And hey, can we compare them? And more, how human do we see our savior? Do we see him as one who fully knew that he was going to hell and going to come back, so it's not really that much of a sacrifice? Or do we see him as someone who was fully human, experiencing the absolute worst torture of all, so that maybe some might be saved, or all might be saved, depending on, you know, you're Christian. Yeah, yeah. Yes. I think maybe the big question really is, how do we wrestle with the humanity of our savior more than, is he like this mouse, which he kind of is. All right. Is that it? Is that our final notes? We ready to wrap this one up?
Sure.
All right. In that case, we're heading on to our wrap up. As always, we're going to start I'm going to let everyone know what the bonus question at the end is. Yeah, we have a bonus question. If you're a Patreon, Captivate listener, or Apple Podcast listener, you're going to hear us ask how our personal faith journeys relate to Sora and Riku's journeys in the games. So we're going to get a little personal, talk a little testimony real quick. But first, we're going to give our recommendations. I'm going to recommend everyone play Kingdom Hearts Fragmentary Passage and also Birth by Sleep, because you know what? Kingdom Hearts is my favorite thing ever. And I don't recommend it enough because I feel like I sound like a broken record. But if there was ever an episode that I was like, hey, listen, if you're a Kingdom Hearts fan and you haven't played the Fragmentary Passage, you're missing some huge chunks of this story that are really worthwhile. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Christian, what's your recommendation for this episode?
I'm going to offer an anti-recommendation so you don't have to suffer like I did. If you would like to waste an hour and 40 minutes of your time, then go watch Skinamarink, a 2022 horror film, a very experimental horror film that has nothing of substance inside of it. I said it. Here we go. I don't care what anyone says about it being art. It's not art. It was an excuse to make a cheap movie, and we all got played.
All right. Barbara, what is your recommendation for this episode?
Well, I just finished watching a new anime series. I think it's called My Happy Marriage. And it was not at all what I expected it to be. So it's about this woman who was basically, like, neglected by her family because when, you know, her mother passed, her father remarried, and kind of like a Cinderella-esque kind of thing where she became like the servant of the household and stuff. And when she got old enough, both of her and her sister were sent away to be in arranged marriages. But then you add in supernatural abilities, you add in demons called grotesqueries, and then the unsealing of, like, all this demonic stuff that just threw a wrench in everything. And I'm just like, I thought this was supposed to be like a
nice,
yeah, like a nice happy marriage thing, but it was really interesting, I thought.
Man, the realms of things, like the totality of things I've just not seen that you guys make me aware of is just mind blowing. That sounds interesting, man. Okay, James, What's your recommendation this episode?
I am going to recommend and commend to you all one of my favorite YouTubers who his channel is, I'm assuming it's a he, is about 90% just Kingdom Hearts memery.
Beautiful.
This YouTube channel goes by the name of Just a Pancake. Please go type into YouTube. Do it right now. I see Josh doing it right now. Type in Just a Pancake, Kingdom Hearts, into your YouTube. Watch all of his summary videos on Kingdom Hearts. I promise you, you will laugh like no one's business if you are a longtime fan of Kingdom Hearts. My wife and I quote them to each other frequently still. And it's a good, good, fun time. And if you forgot what's happened, he has summary videos of like each game. And then he combines them all into an extra long summary video, and it's humorous. Just a Pancake.
Yeah, look that up. Also, just in general, this isn't even like a real recommendation. Look up on YouTube explaining Kingdom Hearts to a friend. It doesn't matter who does it; they're always funny. All of them are funny because you can't explain this to a normie. I'm gonna let you guys know, if you're a Kingdom Hearts fan, you listen this far, I hate to break it to you. You're not going to be able to explain this game to someone who plays it, who does not play it. It just, you could barely explain it to someone who does play it.
Yeah.
John.
Maybe at an 80%.
Yeah.
At best.
Yeah. Is what it is. All right. So hang in there. If you want to hear our bonus question, go over to Captivate, Apple Podcasts, Patreon, one of those things. Of course, we do ask everybody to rate and review the show on Podchaser, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Again, I want to do a big thanks to James Barrett for supporting the show. People like you make this possible, James. You rock, as well as James the host. We can't do it without hosts. Remember, we're all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests.
Check out our merch online at the SG Shop. There you can find clothing such as hat, extra soft t-shirts, sweaters, hoodies, and more things like glassware, mugs, bags, and posters. My favorite shirt design is the one that says all reading counts, so make sure you check out the store and find your new favorite merch.
Hello, friends. If you like Systematic Geekology, then there's a host of other podcasts in our network that we think you will like just as much. And so we're part of the Anazal Ministry Podcast Network, and we hope that you can hop over and subscribe with all the podcasts that are in our network. Like, for instance, The Homily, which is, hey, Pastor Will Rose's sermon here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church. You have another podcast called The Whole Church Podcast, the OG, the originals, the beginner of it all. Yes, Joshua Noel and TJ working for unity among the church and having great conversations with the wide spectrum of those who are involved in Christian ministry and the church. You have My Seminary Life by Brandon Knight, who's discussing what he's learning in seminary, what's he is learning his theological studies and bringing to the surface those big things that we're wrestling with and thinking through theologically in the church and beyond. There's the Let Nothing Move You podcast from Christian Ashley, who is walking through the Bible in a very Bible study type fashion and walking through the biblical narrative. You have Dummy for Theology. I don't think Joshua is a dummy, but hey, he's going to lift up theological themes that he's thinking about and wrestling with. And maybe there's not a lot of answers, but there's definitely a lot of great questions out there that he's lifting up with some great theologians across the whole spectrum of Christianity. And then there's the Bible After Hours. Man, if you like to get risky, if you like to get controversial, there's this foul-mouthed preacher who goes through the Bible from a more progressive point of view, challenging the status quo of the modern church. Yeah, yeah, you don't want any kids around with that podcast. And then you have the Clydes, one of my favorite couples that I like to listen to. One of the hosts here on Systematic Ecology, Taylor and Elizabeth Clyde, go through weekly discussions and kind of a devotional, conversational method of what's going on in their lives, where they see God moving in their lives, and what God is up to in the world. So those are the podcasts, a part of the AMP network. Subscribe, follow. We hope you can be a part of all that great network with the wonderful podcasts at AMP.